Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you're with us today. We're talking about something that affects many families. Alzheimer's disease is many people's worst nightmare. The disease is ultimately fatal, but usually lasts for several years, gradually robbing individuals of their memories and independence. An estimated 5.4 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, and the projections are that that number may triple by 2050. Today, we're looking at how this devastating disease affects individuals and families. The stigma around memory loss. How does this isolate people with Alzheimer's? What's the impact of the high cost of care on loved ones? I'm joined this hour by Jason Brandt, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and neurology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He's also director of the Cortical Function Laboratory at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. Professor Brandt, welcome back to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Pleasure to be here.
And also with us is Carmel Roque, Chief Executive Officer of Keswick Multicare, a nonprofit facility in Baltimore that offers long-term assisted living, adult day services, and post-hospital rehabilitation. Carmel has a background as a licensed clinical social worker. She's worked in the field of senior care in various roles in Maryland and Virginia for years. Welcome to Midday, Carmel.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Professor Brandt, tell me and you are a PhD, so yes. you deserve the doctorate. We just tend to focus that on medical doctors. Tell us in basic terms what happens to the brain when somebody has Alzheimer's.
Well, Alzheimer's is a progressive brain disease, and what that means is that the brain cells, which are called neurons, nerve cells, die, and they die in a more or less predictable fashion. Certain brain cells in areas of the brain supporting memory and supporting higher cognitive functions are the first to die. And then the disease spreads throughout the brain until in the end of the disease, really the whole brain is not functioning very well. And there's widespread brain dysfunction. Exactly what causes the cascade of neurologic events is still a mystery to us. We know what some of the neuropathological features are. That is, we know some of the abnormalities that occur in the brain, but we really don't know what causes it. What's the spark that causes the fuse to burn?
And we really don't know why some people get it and others don't?
Well, we know some of the risk factors. We know many of the risk factors.
Such as?
The primary risk factor is aging. It's a disease associated with age. I often tell patients and families, well, the one sure way not to get Alzheimer's disease is to die young.
Although there are some people who get it relatively young.
Right, right. It's said in part in jest, but it's a disease that's associated with aging. And so one might have a genetic program to develop Alzheimer's disease, but if you die before age 60 or 65, you might never display the illness. And that's one of the reasons why we have a lot more Alzheimer's disease around now than we did 50 years ago, simply because people are living longer.
You say it's associated with age, and yet I've also read that you say it's not normal aging. It is not just, well, this is happening, it happens to all people.
Well, that's correct. It's not normal aging. We think that we know that there are very specific pathological changes, abnormal proteins that get deposited in the brain in a more or less predictable fashion. These abnormal proteins cause the nerve cells to be unable to communicate with each other. We call these proteins plaques, the amyloid plaques that build up in the brain. They prevent nerve cells from communicating with each other, and then those nerve cells will themselves die. They will degenerate. Within the cells, there are tangled proteins called neurofibrillary tangles. These two features, the plaques and the tangles, are the classic features of Alzheimer's disease that were first described by Dr. Alzheimer in 1909. That was his major advancement, that is studying patients during life and then looking at their brains post-mortem and seeing these very specific pathological changes. And so we know what the pathology is, but we don't have yet a way of preventing that or getting rid of it.
So it's fair to say we really don't have effective treatments.
There are approved medications for Alzheimer's disease, but they really are symptomatic treatments. They don't affect the basic biology of the disease. They work a little bit in some patients. They're not really cures for the disease. So if we talk about pharmacology, we have some approved medicines, but they're symptomatic relief. We do have treatments that are largely psychosocial treatments and environmental treatments. That is, we have ways of making the lives of patients and their families and caregivers better. And that's ways of modifying the environment to support the patient and make functioning easier.
And that's exactly why I want to talk to Carmel Roque of Keswick Multicare, because, the question presents itself, why is diagnosis important if we don't have really effective treatments that get to the course of the disease?
I think that that's a twofold issue. First of all, it's very important to be able to distinguish between what is cognitive aging that's going to occur in a healthy adult and what is a disease process. And if you don't know the difference, you may in fact think that you are suffering from a disease. And what a terrible burden, emotional burden, to think that you have Alzheimer's or symptoms related to some kind of a cognitive impairment that you don't have. On the other hand, if you don't really understand and you have not been told that you have a disease process, you can't begin to do the things that you and your family, because this is very much not a disease that just affects the individual. This is always affects the social fabric of a person's life, their family, their spouse, their larger social environment. If you don't understand that you have this disease and you don't understand the implications of that, you have no opportunity to prepare in any way. And you have no opportunity to actually begin to marshal your resources, which in many cases really are the people who surround you, who love you and care about you. And so everybody is sort of operating in the dark. And it really begins to be very important, particularly as the disease progresses and judgment maybe is impaired, the ability to find one's way around safely, managing in your home environment in a safe way may really be impacted over time. And if no one knows there's anything wrong and you don't know there's anything wrong, you've really sort of created a perfect storm for very bad, unnecessary outcomes.
On Midday on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease with Carmel Roque of Keswick Multicare and Professor Jason Brandt of Johns Hopkins. And you, if you phone us at 410-662-8780 or email us midday@wypr.org. So you say screening and diagnosis is important, but we don't really have good ways of screening until symptoms are pretty far along, correct?
Well, there are lots of methods for screening people for milder cognitive impairments. There are screening tests that physicians are knowledgeable about. Mm-hmm. Actually, I've developed a screening instrument that's available on the web for free if anyone is interested.
Tell me about it.
It's called the Memory Screener. The website is www.alzcast.org.
A-L-Z-C-A-S-T.
Not K-A-S-T.
Yes, I understand. Now you just confused a whole bunch of people. Let's do this again.
A-L-Z-C-A-S-T.org.
We will link to that from our website, the Midday page at WIPR. But in a nutshell, tell me what you look at,
right,
in that test.
So it looks at a variety of risk factors for the development of Alzheimer's disease. It looks at neurologic features. It looks at family history features. It looks at patient complaints. So that's a patient's or a person's subjective sense that there's something wrong with their memory or cognition is, in fact, a predictor of incident dementia, higher likelihood of dementia. And in addition, we have a memory test built into this instrument. It is totally anonymous if anyone wants to take it. I suggest that if people take it, there's a printout that comes with it. They can take it to their doctors or share it with members of their families. An individual can take the assessment about him or herself, but also about a family member who you're concerned about.
Well, Carmel Roque, when we look at early stages of cognitive impairment, I mean, you pointed out a couple minutes ago that we shouldn't assume that every impairment is Alzheimer's. So, I mean, when you're working with families, I mean, do you sort of encourage them to think about that possibility, which I would think is one of the worst possibilities because it is a progressive and ultimately fatal disease? Or do you say, you know, wait until it's more clear? What kind of advice do you give families?
I actually, you know, I guess the one way to answer that is that, you know, all families are different and all situations are different. So there isn't really a sort of cookie cutter method of approach. But when we are engaging with older adults in the community, one of the things, for instance, we do with the brain health program is we're encouraging people to come in and to learn about how their brain works and to learn about the things that can add to cognitive health. And those are lifestyle changes that people can make. One of the things that frequently happens is that it will become clear that there's something maybe going on a little bit beyond what we think of as sort of cognitive aging in a more normal fashion. And those people, we will encourage them to go see their doctor. And one of the reasons you want someone to go get checked out is not only the desire that they would have early diagnosis, if in fact they do have an illness that's causing dementia, but also they may have something that's treatable, and we really want to pick up on that early and take care of it. People can begin to see cognitive decline because they're drinking too much, and this is an issue for older adults, or they're not sleeping well, and maybe they haven't for quite a while. Or their nutrition is not appropriate, and perhaps they actually have something else going on, diabetes or other kinds of deficiencies that could be causing it. So we definitely want to know as soon as we can. What I find is that many families and individuals don't really want to know. And that's a whole separate issue.
That is a separate issue, and it's one we will get into after we take a quick break. We're going to talk more about Alzheimer's, including the potential of diet to slow the disease, the impact of the disease on your brain. You can join this conversation. Are you caring for someone with Alzheimer's disease? What do you wish other people understood about it? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. It affects almost 5.5 million Americans and their families. In the face of limited treatment options, what can be done to help those who have been diagnosed? I'm joined by clinical neuropsychologist Jason Brandt of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Carmel Roque, CEO of Keswick Multicare, which offers long-term assisted living, adult day services, and post-hospital rehab. Yesterday, I spoke with Myrta Wallace Woods, who is involved in outreach and educational programs with the Greater Maryland chapter of the Alzheimer's Association.
Myrta Wallace Woods co-facilitates two monthly support groups in Howard County, the Early Stage Memory Cafe, as well as a group for people in the early stage of dementia. She and I talked about what it was like for her caring for her mom, who died of Alzheimer's disease in 2010.
My mother was diagnosed of Alzheimer's, fully diagnosed, in 2005. And she was just totally in denial. She kept saying, no, the doctor's wrong, I don't have Alzheimer's, and I'm just fine, I'm just forgetful, a little bit forgetful like most old people. So 2005, I took her to Houston. I was living in Houston, and I thought it would be easier for me to, you know, have her there. And she found the keys to her car and just decided to go for a ride. Well, in the city of Houston, which is huge, she got lost, and there was a silver alert for her for 48 hours. And then her doctor in Orlando, Florida, suggested that I bring her back. So I brought her back, and I had to quit my career and move in with her and take care of her.
How did it affect your relationship with your mother?
It was in the beginning when they go through the anger stage, because they all go through it. And particularly in the evenings, they go through sundowners. My mother became, you know, just very aggressive and mad and angry and frustrated. So that was difficult. I mean, she would try to kick me across the room and tell me to get out, and I was trying to steal from her. And this is just so typical of this disease that it's just mind-boggling how someone can change like that. That was hard for me because here's a woman that, you know, was my best friend all my life, and this was a behavior I had never seen. Once that happened, it's up to the neurologist, of course, but he gave her some medication to kind of calm that behavior down, and it eventually brought her back, you know, to the sweet self that she was. And I tell you what else was hard. The day that she looked at me and she didn't know who I was, I left her with Yamile, my CNA, and I went out, and I tell you what, I cried and cried and cried in my car. Because that's hard when your loved one looks at you and you know they don't know who you are.
Myrta Wallace Woods, we talked yesterday about her experience helping her mother, who had Alzheimer's for 5 years. This is Midday on WYPR, and you can be part of this conversation. Call us with your questions at 410-662-8780 or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Carmel Rock of Keswick MultiCare, I assume you've heard, you've been with families going mm-hmm. through this. Mm-hmm. What kinds of activities can help?
I think that part of it, once again, it sort of depends on the individual and where they are in their disease process. But this issue of a person being constantly frustrated by their circumstance is very, very typical. And so I think being able to find engaging activities that aren't too stressful for the person, so they're not constantly being confronted with, I can't do that anymore, is really important. We talk a lot to family caregivers about really thinking about the environment and the interaction they have with their loved one as supporting that person to kind of make up for the things that their brain's not doing for them anymore. So when they can't remember something, not confronting them with that, but finding ways to help them have memory prompts. At a certain point, they won't remember they don't remember, and so making that an issue...
It becomes less stressful. But until then?
Until then, it's stressful for the individual themselves, and it's usually stressful for the family caregiver as well. So we see a lot of this desire to have our loved one be the person we've always known, and then it's this sort of long goodbye in some ways, because there are many ways that the person is losing their own sense of themselves, their own sense of personal dignity, their own sense of personal worth, and really their caregiver or their loved one is witnessing that and experiencing loss at the same time. So we are always looking at ways to strengthen the caregiver's ability to be present and to sort of cope with these changes that are occurring, and to know enough about the disease process and the symptoms so that they don't take everything personally, but they're able to understand this is one of the things that happens when your frontal lobe is damaged and your judgment has been impaired and you can't make good decisions anymore. So it's really working both sides of it.
We've gotten some calls from people with questions about chemicals. Elizabeth is calling us from Baltimore. Elizabeth, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
There were some years ago. Thank you. Yes, hello. Thank you
for taking my And Elizabeth, call. Your question? Elizabeth, I think you need to turn your radio down. None of us can take in a radio that's a couple seconds off from where we are.
Okay, I'm sorry. Some years ago, I saw a special on public television about a Canadian doctor who was doing a lot of research on Alzheimer's and the connection between all of the chemicals we now use in our homes and have been used since the 50s to kill germs, to bleach clean our bathrooms and things we put in our laundry and even our baths, that this heavy use of cleansing chemicals containing bleach and all types of additives. And he was finding some connection with the effect on the brain of all of these chemicals. Has any further research been done, please?
Let's see what Professor Brandt can tell us about that. Thanks for the call, Elizabeth.
Well, yes, it's a very interesting question. And the search for chemical exposures or environmental toxins as a cause or one of the causes of Alzheimer's disease has been going on for a long time. My understanding of the current science is that there hasn't been a link established between any specific environmental exposures or toxic exposures and Alzheimer's disease. We know that some chemicals are in fact neurotoxic. They damage brain cells, but in a way that's different from Alzheimer's disease. For example, certain pesticides and herbicides have been linked, for example, to Parkinson's disease, which is a degenerative brain disease as well, but of a different sort. But I don't know of any good research that has shown a link between Alzheimer's disease and household chemicals.
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Barbara is calling us from Dundalk. Barbara, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Let me turn my call off. My question is, let me give you a for instance. My mother had Alzheimer's. I know the symptoms. I know how she felt. And I recently had a mastectomy. And they give me this different prescription. Well, I'm going down the road, and I all of a sudden realize I don't know where I'm going. I don't know my name, but I know my legs and part of me can get me where I'm going. Of course, it was home. I called my oncologist. They called Dr. Kelly. Come to find out, I had been having some sort of those symptoms all along, and they were symptoms that my mother had. Come to find out, my body does not make vitamin B12. A couple months later, I heard on your radio station that they were checking into that. And I want to know if vitamin B12 can be given to Alzheimer's people to slow the process down, to keep them stable, so they can enjoy life a little bit more. Or like me, maybe because I was only like 64, 65, I'm having the same symptoms my mother was having.
Barbara, thank you for posing the question. Let me see what our panel says about it.
Well, one of the things that I think this really raises, the caller raises, is the importance of getting a diagnosis, because clearly she had a circumstance where they were able to identify something that was contributing to her cognitive issues.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's one thing to have a vitamin B12 deficiency, and it's another thing to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
For sure.
As Carmel pointed out before, there are many different causes of dementia, and one of them is low B12. And when someone goes to a physician for a dementia workup, blood studies are done, and that's one of the things we look for is low B12, because that is very, very treatable. People get B12 injections all the time to supplement what their body can't produce. Thyroid abnormalities can result in cognitive impairment. Problems with diabetes can result in cognitive impairment. A thorough differential diagnosis needs to be done.
Barbara, thank you for the call. This is a great time for me to ask you, Professor Brandt, about the research that you're doing on diet and Alzheimer's.
So, yes, we're conducting a study now on dietary interventions or dietary treatments for early stage Alzheimer's disease and even pre-dementia, which we called mild cognitive impairment, MCI. We know that in Alzheimer's disease, the brain does not use glucose or sugar normally. Normally, the cells in the body use glucose to produce energy. And we know from studies using PET scans and other techniques that the brain in Alzheimer's disease doesn't use glucose normally. One of the things that we could think about is using other nutrients and other substances to produce energy. And we know that fat can do that. The metabolism of fat produces ketone bodies that can be used by the brain for energy.
We talked about ketones when we did a show a few weeks ago about intermittent fasting.
Yes.
And
yes.
How if you don't eat for 12 or 15 hours, your body is more likely to make or draw on ketones.
That's exactly right. And if you have low carbohydrates, normally, you know, we think that fat is bad in our country because we eat a lot of carbohydrates. And if you do that, the fat that you eat gets stored in your blood vessels and causes all kinds of mischief. But if you don't take in carbohydrates, you burn fat for fuel. And that can be a very effective way of circumventing the problem of insulin resistance and glucose metabolism abnormalities in Alzheimer's disease. So we're currently doing a study that compares two diets. One is a Mediterranean diet that's widely recommended for older adults, which is a diet that's very high in fruits and vegetables and grains and fish, very low in meat and dairy products. And comparing that.
I think of olive oil when
exactly.
I think of the Mediterranean diet.
Precisely. Olive oil, a little
plant,
bit of.
Plant oils, not
little,
animal fats.
A little bit of wine is good on a Mediterranean diet, fish, vegetables, and so forth. And comparing that to a high fat, low carbohydrate diet. We're randomizing people to one of the two dietary treatments for 12 weeks with cognitive testing before and at the end of the study. We are looking for participants now. If anyone is interested in finding out more, they can call our offices at Johns Hopkins.
And what is that number?
And the number is area code 410-955-1647.
410-955-1647. 955-1647. We'll put that on our webpage also.
Great.
So how far along are you in this research? I mean, have you started getting results?
We've just started recruiting people. We have a handful of people in the study so far. It's been difficult to recruit people. A lot of people are fearful about being on a high-fat, potentially being on a high-fat diet. But the thing to know is that it really is not bad for your heart or your cardiovascular system if you don't eat carbohydrates.
So what is your timeline for giving us some answers?
It's going to be a two to three year study. So you'll have to have me back.
Carmel Rope, what has been your experience? You have residents with Alzheimer's and you're feeding them.
Right.
And do you notice differences in how diet affects them?
I think, you know, by the time individuals are actually in the nursing home for long-term care, they're at the end stages of their disease process. So where we really see the difference is when we're engaging with older adults who are living in the community, who are coming in for the brain health programming, which has a whole piece that centers on nutrition, or are coming for the diabetes prevention and management education, which you know, if you manage your diabetes, you're going to have the benefits that accrue to cognitive, your cognition being strong. So part of what we're seeing is that definitely individuals who go through the 8-week brain health curriculum learn about nutritional lifestyle changes, learn about sleep, the importance of sleep, learn about the importance of basic exercise, that and socialization and connection actually do show improvement in their cognitive post-tests. So I don't really know what the answer would be on the end stage of the disease. For, you know, my take on end stage, any terminal illness is one should eat whatever one wants, whenever one wants at that point. So, you know, my grandfather ate chocolate ice cream for the last, you know, couple of weeks of his life because that's what he wanted. And he had end stage Parkinson's disease. So I think it's really earlier on, both while you're still relatively healthy, maybe have mild cognitive impairment symptoms, maybe have early diagnosis, that these kinds of lifestyle changes really can, I think, have benefits. I'm thrilled that Dr. Brandt's doing this research because it really goes to the heart of it. We don't have a cure, but there may be things that we can do that strengthen our ability to maybe
postpone the
postpone
symptoms.
Postpone it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that can account for a lot. We need to take another quick break here. When we come back, more on Alzheimer's. What might the future hold for a cure? Are you concerned about developing dementia? Have you made any changes to your lifestyle or diet in order to try to ward off Alzheimer's? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. 1 in 3 older American dies with Alzheimer's disease or another type of dementia. Today we're discussing how far treatment and screening have come and what the future could hold for curing this disease. I'm speaking with clinical neuropsychologist Jason Brandt of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Carmel Roque, Chief Executive Officer of Keswick MultiCare, which offers long-term assisted living, adult day services, and post-hospital rehab. You can be part of this conversation. Send us your questions. What would you want to know if you're going to develop Alzheimer's? Have you asked your doctor to be screened for Alzheimer's? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We got an email from Maria, which says, in part, please discuss dealing with early onset dementia. My husband is only 55. My problem is that everything is written in terms of dealing with a parent or older couples, not the needs of someone like me who is still working and needs to continue doing so for more than a decade. Even the facilities and their activities seem inappropriate for my husband. The music and memory programs are for people who are in their prime in the 40s and 50s. My husband was only born in 1960. He once Rock, not Guy Lombardo. What is there for people in our situation?
Carmel Rock. I think that, you know, even though we know that it's a small percentage of individuals who actually have early onset, it's a devastating circumstance that particularly I think couples find themselves in. And one of the initiatives that I know we're involved in at Keswick, and I know the Alzheimer's Association is really promoting, are these early stage memory cafes and activity programs that are very much geared toward the younger, early onset individual, so that you can have the person can have an experience of actually being with their peer group, doing the kinds of things they've always enjoyed, and not trying to commingle individuals who are in, let's say, their 50s with people who are in their late 80s. And I also find commingling people who are at very different stages of the disease is not a very productive thing to do either. So we really are at a point where we're sort of customizing programming, and there's not anywhere near enough of it.
There's not
anywhere near enough of these kinds of program options available. It's one of the reasons why we're going to start a program at Keswick. And I know the Alzheimer's Association can list where those programs are available. The other option for a person would be an adult day services program. But once again, very few of them are actually geared specifically for people with dementia or people with early onset. So there's not much that's been developed yet for that group.
Mary is calling us. Mary, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Hello. I'm calling about a friend of mine who has been dealing with anorexia for about 15 or 16 years. She's 64 and at this time is showing some fairly significant cognitive issues. And I'm wondering how this fits into what you've been talking about in terms of, now this is purposeful, but still nutritional deprivation that's gone on for years and how it might be affecting her brain.
Mary, thank you for the question. Professor Brent?
Well, it's very clear that nutritional abnormalities can result in a whole host of neurologic problems. The lack of protein in the diet, the lack of thiamine in the diet has been linked to severe memory loss. We know that there's a syndrome called Korsakoff syndrome that's caused by a form of amnesia that's caused by lack of thiamine in the diet. We already talked about vitamin deficiencies. So it's very clear that nutritional disorders result in cognitive impairments. The most important thing is to get that person well and get them refed. The caller mentioned that she thought it was intentional, and you know, it's sort of quasi-intentional. I'm sure she doesn't mean to be ill, but it is clearly an illness, anorexia nervosa, and there are treatments for it. All large university medical centers have eating disorders programs, and they should look into that.
Mary, thank you for that call. Ben has called us from Baltimore. Ben, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Just a couple comments about, from a caregiver's perspective, I think it's important for the families to sit down, discuss financial issues. Power of attorneys are essential. If you could pre-plan years before the event ever happens, to get long-term care insurance. But a question I have for both of you is, could you comment on the effect of anesthesia and also traumatic brain injuries in relationship to Alzheimer's?
Ben, thank you for those questions.
I will just say that you can sort of generalize and say that anything that causes an insult to your brain is likely to add to risk factors for cognitive impairment. And so Dr. Brandt, I know, knows more of the details on that. But we need to be understanding that our brain is like our other organs. We need to have proper nutrition, and we need to take care not to cause damage to our brains. And anything that does can have very serious consequences for our cognition and for our risk for developing diseases.
I'd like us to hear another part of the conversation I had with Myrta Wallace Woods yesterday when she was describing how Alzheimer's affected her mother's ability to communicate.
My mother, we're from Cuba, so she spoke English and Spanish. As the short-term memory went, she reverted fully to the Spanish language. And then from there, she went into a gibberish that you couldn't understand, but you just kind of had to learn what she was looking at and what she was pointing to. And then it got to the stage where she no longer spoke. But when she was still speaking, she would get, you know, of course, words confused. she would ask, where's my dog? And she would ask me, where's my chicken? Well, you know that she's talking to you, but she just forgot the word for dog and said chicken. So that is something that you have to go through. But it's understanding and engaging them in meaningful conversation. And that's important, sitting down with your loved one and just engaging them in a meaningful conversation. If you know what was important to them when they were younger, get them to talk to you because they want to continue to be social. She wanted to continue to talk to me. So I knew that she loved interior design. So I would sit down with her, you know, with Interior Design magazines, and we would talk. That was meaningful to her, and it was something that was long-term memory.
You're nodding, mm-hmm. Carmel. This sounds like, I don't want to put words in your mouth. This is a technique others could use.
Yes, and that's a very familiar sort of pattern. You know, the great concern people have when they first learn they have this diagnosis is the loss of their sense of themselves. And the people who are closest to them, who have a shared memory with them, can, in fact, engage in ways that help the person to maintain some sense of their personal self and their personal dignity. And it really is a matter of, you know, we talk about entering into that person's world. It's easier for some people than others. Some people really, you know, don't like the idea. I don't want to, you know, get into a fantasy world with my mother, or I don't want to lie to my mother about the fact that dad is dead, or I don't, you know, a whole range of things. But really, it's being able to enter into their world and engage in ways where you can sort of touch each other and support the person's sense of themselves, whether or not they get all the facts exactly right. It takes practice, and it takes support. It's not something we all just sort of start out knowing how to do.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who said he seems like he's always seeing headlines about this research or that research in mice and wants to know why it takes so long to get treatments for humans.
It's easier to work with mice. Yeah. Mice reproduce very quickly. We can produce an animal model. We can take a large group of mice and genetically program them to display the plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's disease, and so they're a useful laboratory model. It takes a long time because there's a very prescribed pattern of research whereby drugs get developed and then tested for safety and then tested for efficacy and then small-scale studies in humans and large-scale studies in humans. And all of these things are very, very carefully prescribed by the FDA and other regulatory bodies. There are estimates that over 99% of the clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease have been failures. The public doesn't hear about most of them. We hear about the potential successes. But there have been hundreds of clinical trials of Alzheimer's medications over the past 20 years or so, and they've been failures. Some might argue that we're barking up the wrong tree. Some might say that by the time people are displaying signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's, it's too late, that we really need to start before somebody has full-blown Alzheimer's. We should start in the MCI phase, the mild cognitive impairment phase, or even earlier. We know that the brain changes are taking place in the brain of somebody 20 years or more before they start to display symptoms. And so it might be that by the time somebody gets diagnosed with Alzheimer's, the medications are not going to be that effective anymore. We need to start even earlier. So there are lots and lots of reasons why research has been challenging. Funding has always been an issue. I think that funding for Alzheimer's disease research has recently increased a bit, but we're still way below where we need to be. So if I could...
It's odd, when you stop and think about how many families already are coping with this or fear coping with it.
I suspect it touches one way or another every family in America. I don't know a single family where there's either a person with dementia or somebody caring for somebody or knows a loved one with Alzheimer's disease. It really is affecting every family in America.
We have just a couple minutes left. Elliot calling us from Annapolis. Can you make your comment quickly?
Yes. My sister wanted to borrow money and went to the house, looked in the checkbook, and realized that my mother, who never balanced the book, had been writing checks, and we could track back to the date where things really shifted for him by his handwriting. Mm. And through my best friend, we found Keswick, and my father was there for years, right to the point where one day he smiled at me and said, "What's your name?" Mm. But he was even allowed to die there, and people there sang to him for the last 3 days. It was just a miracle. So there can be a possibility of meeting this without it being a horrible, horrible thing, although it is a devastating disease. And I want to be in the program, so I'm going to call.
Okay. And again, that phone number for the research that Professor Brandt's involved in is 410-955-1647. Thank you, Elliot, for the call. We have just a minute or so. I will, and Professor Brandt, even though obviously this was a compliment to the facility that Carmel runs, you were nodding your head vigorously at Elliot's call.
Well, I think it speaks to the kinds of care that we can engage in about caring for people while we're waiting for a cure, while we're waiting for the miracle drug or the preventative treatment, that there's a lot that we can do to take care of people, take care of families. Carmel and her team at Keswick is a prime example, and the caller's experience of singing and making life pleasant.
Joy.
Moments of joy, exactly. Moments of joy in the context of advanced dementia.
And I think the other part that for me has become so important is this issue of helping older adults learn more about how their brain functions, learn how to do the things that strengthen their cognition. For the very fact that Dr. Brandt talked about, that the changes are happening 20 years before people get symptoms. So if there are things that we can be doing, lifestyle changes we can be doing that can make a difference, I just think that's such a positive.
I really want to thank you both for this conversation. Jason Brandt of the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Carmel Roque, Chief Executive Officer of Keswick MultiCare in Baltimore. Thanks.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Myrtle Wallace Woods, an advocate with the Alzheimer's Association of Greater Maryland, for sharing her experience caring for her mother. More information about the Alzheimer's Association's Greater Maryland chapter, go to www.alz.org/Maryland. We'll post information about these resources on the midday page. And I want to thank Dangerously Delicious Pies for lunch for midday guests today. Locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a wide variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More at dangerouspiesbalt.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. Summer's here. We're going to talk about gardening. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.